Good morning, Joe Langlin.
Good morning, Vern. How are you?
Oh, I'm especially fine because we've already been having a good time chatting. Tell me a little bit about making this recording when you did, because, or even a little bit about putting Poulenc, Ravel, and Debussy together on a recording of these pieces.
Well, I didn't know the Poulenc Sonata at that time. I knew Debussy and Ravel's works very well, but Paul Crossley and I wanted to put a really meaningful French album together. Mm-hmm. And he has been a great champion of Poulenc's piano music throughout his career. Mm-hmm. So he suggested this piece, and I thought, well, how wonderful. Nobody plays the Poulenc Sonata. Let me get to know it. So I started learning the piece, and I found it incredibly exciting and a beautiful work in its own quirky ways, you know, Poulenc's mm-hmm. signature sounds and harmony. So we decided to put that together, and we went to London back in, I think, the early 90s, and we put this album together in St. John Smith Square.
You know, it's really, I think we all remember falling in love with Poulenc, don't we? Because they're just when he kind of gets to you and you just really discover him and he gets inside you, it's really special music.
Well, and the Violin Sonata has become even more meaningful as I've played it over the years, that, you know, it's an homage to García Lorca, the great mm-hmm. the Spanish poet who was, you know, murdered during the Civil War. And so there's a lot of references hidden, very hidden in the music, mm-hmm. you know, paying his tribute to this poet. And so it outwardly has some beautiful lyrical moments, but inside there's a lot of turmoil, even violence in the music.
Yeah. And then I'm going to make you repeat the story that you just told me because it was a lot of fun about playing the piece that we just heard or about trying to play the perpetual motion that we just heard about the filming.
Oh, yeah. Well, after this album came out, Sony Classical hired a film company in Norway to do a music video. They wanted to sort of like do the, you know, classical equivalent of the rock video, pop video. And so I happened to be in Bergen. And so this film crew came over to try to film me. And they wanted me to, of course, mine everything. But the thing is, they wanted the most spectacular scenery. Mm-hmm. So they said, can you do this last movement of the Ravel, the perpetual motion? And then they took me to this seaside rock, huge rock formation. And they wanted me to play there. The problem is this perpetual motion goes by so fast with the, you know, playing the bow flying all over the place. But the wind was so powerful that it was literally blowing my bow off the violin. And I was fearful that not only would I, you know, look not terribly realistic, but I might even lose my bow and have it fall into the ocean. So I asked them if I could play something else instead that could, you know, be a little safer on my instrument. So the film crew agreed. So we switched to Ravel's Tzigane, this wonderful showpiece in the style of a gypsy. And so we did that. But then they wanted me to go into town and do other scenes. So they thought, okay, a gypsy, you know, strolling violinist. So they just went up to a restaurant in middle of town, and it was a beautiful summer day. So a lot of diners were having their coffee and lunch in there. And then they asked me to stroll through the restaurant like a gypsy strolling violinist while they were playing back my recording, and I was miming, of course. And it was very, for me, a little bit, you know, awkward at first. And I thought, never, wow, I'm going to be a strolling fiddler. But then all the Norwegian patrons were so friendly. They all, like, you know, started applauding. So that looked really good on film, I presume, you know, and I was strolling through. And then some of them would say, oh, that's very nice playing you're doing. Do you play any Greek? You know, it was very charming. And then we ended up completing the film session at the end of the day. But I never saw the end product. I never received a copy of the video. It's a pity.
What a shame. Joe Langlin, my guest, who's playing tonight with the Gonzaga Symphony. But what I already sense out of you is that in your career of, 30 years or so, we won't count numbers too precisely, that you have just been willing to make a lot of different kinds of music in a lot of ways and just fully participate in music making. Is that a fair assessment of you?
Well, that's my, that is precisely how I view things, because mm-hmm. Number one, playing the violin, of course, I'm very glad I can do it relatively well, but that's just the beginning. I think as a musician, there's certain things that I can do, perhaps that can help the music world a little more. Mm-hmm. Number one, teaching. I like to help younger artists, mm-hmm. And then I realized that I'm very keen to promote new music and to get new works written by composers of our time. and to, you know, have the give the composers a voice, to give them a chance to write something. And so I'm very actively always seeking composers to write things, not only for me, but for other musicians. And so I find that playing the violin is really just a starting point, but I want to do more than just get up on stage and play. And I want to communicate a lot more. So the end result is that I'm a very busy guy. Mm-hmm. I run two music festivals, one in San Diego and the other one's in Hong Kong. And I teach at Rice University, and I do a little teaching at the Juilliard School, my alma mater. And I also have a very active concert career. And so right now I'm here in Spokane, but tomorrow morning I will get on a 5:30 flight a.m. to go back to Houston and rush straight into a teaching studio, teach for a full day, and then all day Wednesday. And then Thursday morning, I run off to New York to play a concert at Lincoln Center during the weekend. So this kind of nonstop activity, yeah, invigorating as it is, it can be tiring.
Of course, yeah, but clearly invigorating. Well, let's jump right into the main piece you're playing here, the Lalo Schifrin Concerto. Did he write this for you?
Yes, it's called Tangos Concertantes. It's not just a collection of tangos, because Lalo Schifrin, as we all know, is the composer of the famous Mission Impossible theme. But he hails from Argentina, grew up in Buenos Aires, and before he went overseas to study with Olivier Messiaen in Paris, mm-hmm. and before he came to America, being brought over as a jazz pianist by Dizzy Gillespie. Mm-hmm. So his roots are very firmly in the Argentine music, and so he knows a lot about tango. In fact, he said he joined Astor Piazzolla's band for a while as the keyboard player, and he's very, very well versed in that. So I think in the early 2000s, I really wanted to play tango. You know, that's another manifestation of my interest. You know, I don't want to play only classical, mm-hmm. But I want to play tango because I love the music of tango. And so I commissioned Lalo Schifrin to write a chamber work. And he ended up writing this gorgeous piece called Letters from Argentina for score for six players. And afterwards, I was so elated. I asked Lalo, would you ever write a violin concerto similarly based on Argentine music, mm-hmm. namely tangos? And he very quickly agreed, and I gathered some orchestras that became all interested, very keen to have Lalo write a violin concerto, his very first violin concerto. So Tangos Concertantes is the result, and it was written in 2009, and I've been playing it ever since. It's a beautiful music. It's not only, it has beautiful tango tunes, but that's not it. It has very edgy harmony, you know, based on his jazz training and background. And it has very serious structure, all very coherently done. And it's very economically written. In other words, it's difficult. It's challenging for everyone concerned, because he aptly named it Concertantes because it means it's a concerto for multiple players. And so the orchestra has many very important solos, you know, for the clarinet, for the principal cello, for the flute, for the oboe. They're beautiful things. Everybody's putting in this sort of combined effort together. So I regard it as a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm. You know, it seems, again, like you found a good composer to work with. He found a good violinist to work with, because, again, his life and your life somewhat parallel, of just being open and versatile and willing to go, you know, into a lot of different places.
Well, the fact is, you know, I first met Lalo in this festival in Switzerland, Verbier. And he was so famous, you know, because I grew up watching the TV shows that he scored for in the 70s, you know, Man from U.N.C.L.E., Mission Impossible, Mannix, and of course, eventually films like Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee and Dirty Harry, all these, you know, iconic movies. And I was actually very intimidated, you know, to meet him. I was very nervous. I thought, well, I don't know. I'm not, you know, really worthy to meet this great composer. But then later on, when we did tour together, he's the nicest man, you know, very thoughtful, very humble, but always dapper, very, very well dressed, you know, impeccably attired and mannered person. It was lovely, really, really wonderful to get to know Lalo. And to this day, you know, I don't know, 9 years after he wrote the violin concerto, he still thanks me for performing his work. Yeah. And it's lovely. And, you know, similarly, if I may just drop names for a second, another very famous composer who's equally humble is John Williams. Mm. He wrote a piece for me also, a chamber work, and he asked for the email address of every player involved so he can write them each a thank you note after the premiere, because he was so taken by what we did. And, wow. And you know, very sweet.
What a nice thing. Zhou Langlin, who's playing this Lalo Schifrin piece tonight, and I think it's just as well that it would speak for itself, but let's just take a little break and hear the second section of a piece that he wrote, a capriccio for clarinet and strings, written for his distant relative David Schifrin, and the string section of the Adelaide Symphony Orchestra, movement 2 of this capriccio, a little bit of the music of Lalo Schifrin. The second movement of a short two-movement work that Lalo Schifrin wrote for his distant relative, the clarinetist David Schifrin. That was movement 2 of the Capriccio for clarinet and strings, David Schifrin, with the string section of the Adelaide Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Lalo Schifrin. My guest, Zhou Langlin, is saying that even if it's not exactly like the violin concerto you play, that was certainly the Lalo Schifrin you know. You know that when you heard that.
Oh, you recognize the harmony, the yeah. edgy sound, the virtuoso writing for the clarinet. I mean, you know, you hear them all in the violin concerto tonight as well. Yeah. It's a signature Lalo sound.
Right. Yeah. And so that piece with, not the piece you heard, but certainly the Lalo Schifrin, what was the name, Concertantes?
Tangles Concertantes.
Tangles Concertantes, yeah. Which, aren't you glad that within a two-word title he described the piece so well, too, that people kind of know what it's going to be if you hear Tangles Concertantes?
I know. Isn't it's really, and it's unusual, right? Most people would just simply name the piece Violin Concerto, but he doesn't. You know, Tangles Concertantes, very nice.
Nice. And that's one thing. And then you're playing one of these standards, the Sarasate de Zigeuner Weisen, and it's almost like an encore piece that one does. Or talk about the Sarasate.
Oh, Zigeuner Weisen, the Gypsy Airs. Yeah, that's, a lollipop. Everybody loves it. Violinists love it, you know, because it's so idiomatically written, so well written. And for me, actually, it's an incredible piece, you know, for a Spaniard, Sarasate, to write such a authentically, you know, gypsy music is really great. And no wonder it became such a, you know, enormously popular work. And it's, you know, it's the kind of work that's going to make everybody go home happy.
Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about some of the range of the interesting pieces that you have been involved with, that you've had created, the musical styles. You've already suggested a lot of this, but what are a few of other examples of interesting pieces of music that you've gotten involved with?
Well, it's a lot. For instance, a recent album that was released is Joan Tower's Violin Concerto. Mm. Which was nominated for Grammy. I was very happy for that, and it's a very powerful but compact, you know, 22 minute long work. Very difficult for the orchestra as well, that's a super super wonderful piece, and lots of others. I've had composers like Christopher Rouse, even slightly more you know, far field names, you know, like I just mentioned a few minutes ago, John Williams. They all have written for me. Tan Dun.
What sort of thing did Tan Dun write?
Tan Dun wrote a violin concerto called Love. He likes to talk about it as the three stages of love, you know. Like the first movement is actually a hip-hop. It involves a drum set. It's really wild. But sort of like based out of a Peking opera tune. It's very funny. It's like, you know, Peking opera going hip hop. And then the second movement is very pensive, beautiful, long melody. See, he thinks that's, you know, you've gone away from the teenage love and you've gone into your, you know, 20, 30 something love. And then the third movement is a long symphonic poem with violin leading the way. So he says that's mature love. That's when you can look back on life. So he's very philosophical about it. But Tan Dun is always very philosophical, you know. And so I've, you know, had a lot of different works written for me. And I think also even, you know, Stuart Copeland, the drummer from The Police, the rock band, and Howard Shore, the film composer of Lord of the Ring fame. So these composers all have written stuff at the... My suggestion.
That's an awfully nice legacy to have, you know, to have just helped extend what the violinist does. Let's talk for a minute about teaching, because you're teaching at Rice University, which is a really highly regarded advanced music school. So I imagine you get really good students. How are they recently different or influenced by the way the world is, or do they do more styles better, or... How is a violin student now any different than a violin student 30 years ago?
There are more distractions.
Of course.
Now. Mm. You know, I walk by practice rooms at Rice or elsewhere. A lot of people have their heads lowered, looking at their smartphones, mm-hmm. checking on the most recent text and photos and whatnot, Facebook, etc. And so... So that idea is very different from when I was a student. You know, when we walked into a practice room, we just practiced. Mm-hmm. There's nothing else we could do.
Right.
You know, we had no choice. And occasionally when we did take a break, we'd go onto the hallway and chat with each other. But nowadays, they don't chat. They just, you know, look at the phone. Mm-hmm. And I noticed, you know, recently in an orchestra rehearsal, a violinist unpacked her violin, took it out, and took the bow out. And then what does she do? She looks at her phone. Mm. It's not about tuning, not about putting the rosin on, but phone first. Mm. So it's a different world. So I find it a little tougher. But also, if I may just be a little blunt for a minute, that something like YouTube is so omnipresent that when I tell my students to look up a performance so they can start studying a piece, they don't necessarily look for the iconic performances, the really great ones, but they look for whatever it's conveniently posted on YouTube, and they just follow, and often they follow the wrong example. And I find that very alarming, because they just do whatever it's convenient. They don't really think about the pedigree and the quality of the performer. And I find that just a little disappointing. They don't discern the quality of the performance between player A and player B, etc. And whereas when I was, you know, a student, I had to go to the Juilliard Library and dig up every LP there is, and I'll stack them on top of my desk, and I'll listen to them one by one, and then find the one that I like the most, and then start listening to it more carefully, intently, and start studying the piece based on perhaps that model. And so these are the new trends that I find slightly alarming. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, the good thing, though, the positive side of this is that so many talents come from all over the world now, you know. Currently, my class has Asian players, those born in the States as well as in Asia, and of course, American players, and Israeli, and then I've, you know, taught players from Europe as well in the past, and from Russia. So it's a very international bunch these days. And the interesting thing is, with the borders, the musical borders being broken down, especially after Glasnost and Perestroika in Soviet Union, so many Soviet-trained musicians moved to the West. They moved to Western Europe, they moved to the United States or Canada, and they began teaching there. So this sort of so-called Russian school is no longer exclusively Russian. It's really all over the place. And similarly, a French violinist or English violinist might go to New York or Los Angeles to study. And so suddenly, there's no French school anymore. Mm-hmm. In a way, you know, I'm talking about the most essential thing that we can identify players with, dating from perhaps 100 or 80 years ago. You know, you can hear right away, this is a French player, this is a Russian player. But it's much harder. So stylistically, I think it's much more homogenized today. And if you were to blindfold me and play a recording of Jascha Heifetz, Nathan Milstein, Isaac Stern, David Oistrakh, even Horowitz and Rubinstein, I can tell you within a few minutes that, or a few bars even, that these are the players. But today, if you put on a modern day, you know, whiz kid, you know, 28 years old, 25 year old playing the same standard concerto, I couldn't tell you who they are. The distinction between schools and training is no longer there.
So I gather that in your teaching, you probably work pretty hard to try to resist these trends and to try to get more of a distinction from your students? Or what? How do you try to counteract these forces in your own teaching?
Well, I really cannot prevent my students from absorbing information from what's going around. What I try to do is I try to remember what my own teacher, Dorothy DeLay, taught me when I was a student, which was to allow a student, a young person, to develop according to his or her own talent as well as taste. That's very important, that you don't try to make your students sound like you. And I always found that to be a very important thing to remember as a teacher. It's much more interesting for me to hear when my students play. I want to hear, you know, five or six different personalities rather than all ones trying to sound like one person. For me, that's boring. That's not about, you know, a proper upbringing. So I encourage my students to develop their own musical tastes. But again, that comes around to what source material they use. You know, I just said a minute ago about not finding the best performances. That can be a hindrance. But on the other hand, I find the, you know, encouraging the students to explore is very important, because they have to be curious. You know, they want. And another thing you asked about today, And this is a sentiment that I share with many my colleagues around my age group or older, which is young violinists today are much less aware of the lineage of violin playing. You know, they're not curious about who Misha Elman was, who was Fritz Kreisler, who was Zeno Franciscati. Mm-hmm. Even Heifetz is some sort of a distant name to them. You know, they're much more attuned to Gil Shaham, Hilary Hahn, and the other names that are going around today. And that's fine. But as a violinist, it's part of the great joys of being a musician to be a nerd, you know, to actually learn something about where, for instance, you know, where my teacher comes from. You know, I can trace my own violin lineage all the way back to Joachim, Brahms' friend, because my teacher, when I was a teenager, studied with Janos Hubay, the great Hungarian violinist, and Hubay was Joachim's protege. So I tell my students, look, you may not care about this one bit, but I just want to tell you, if you study with me well enough, you can trace your lineage all the way back to Brahms, if that means anything to you, you know, but perhaps it doesn't, you know. And I just hope they won't say, well, good, but who's Joachim? You know, I mean, that would be a really scary moment. Sure. But the thing is, I can't, you know, force curiosity upon my students. I can only encourage them. So this is a thing that I remember, you know, Lynn Harrell, he was, you know, the great cellist. He was talking recently to me about, like, how students are totally unaware of even who Rostropovich was.
Wow.
What did he do? What did Rostropovich do? You know, Jacqueline Dupre or Fournier, you know, who were these great cellists? To them, it didn't really matter. You know, so that's the wrong attitude. And I find that a little alarming in today's young talents.
Yeah. Well, thank you for working hard at keeping them aware. That's all we can do, isn't it?
Well, yeah. It's fun. I really do think it's fun. Yeah. You know, I mean, one thing good about YouTube, having just mentioned, you know, some possible traps, pitfalls in YouTube, but a lot of people have transferred this, you know, very old historical recordings mm-hmm. onto YouTube. Mm-hmm. So you don't need to go to a specialty store to buy a CD anymore.
It's all there.
Yeah, you know, yeah. It's lovely to hear Kreisler and Elman and early Heifetz now readily available on YouTube.
Great. Xiu Lang Lin, on all these subjects, what a treat to have you in our town. Thanks for coming.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Playing with the Gonzaga Symphony Orchestra tonight, a 7:30 concert at the Fox, which in addition to the Brahms Second Symphony includes these two pieces we've been talking about, the Tangos Concertantes of Lalo Schifrin and Zigeuner Weisen of Sarasate. And kind of in the same style of that. Well, first, let me thank you very much for coming in.
All right, thank you.